Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Boquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're heading to Waterbury to open the show with U.S. Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty, who's going to key in on an initiative that could deliver the kind of upgraded firearms background check system that the majority of Americans, gun owners, and NRA members have been calling for or supporting for some time. Then we'll chat with the director of ARI Connecticut, which is celebrating its 65th anniversary this year and continuing to expand services and residential opportunities for the disabled. We'll also invite you to ARI's 11th annual Walk for Independence, which is happening next weekend. And we'll close with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which is working hard at the State House in Hartford on three specific pieces of legislation they hope to see passed that'll help both Connecticut law enforcement agencies and victims of domestic violence here in the state. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Boquette, right after this reminder. YWCA Hartford Region is partnering with Robinson & Cole to present Stand Against Racism on Friday, April 28th from 2 to 3:30 at YWCA's administrative offices on Broad Street in Hartford. Stand Against Racism is a signature campaign of YWCA USA to build community among those who work for racial justice and to raise awareness about the negative impact of institutional and structural racism in our communities. You can register to host your own stand or learn more about this event at standagainstracism.org.
Well, we are pleased to be in Waterbury for this field interview with 5th District Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty, and we've got several items to talk about. And we're going to kick it off with some pretty exciting news. Representative Esty is vice chair of the House Gun Violence Prevention Task Force and part of a growing bipartisan initiative calling on appropriations to provide funds to strengthen the criminal background check system. So, Congresswoman Esty, this has obviously been something that's been on your plate a long time. You and I have worked closely together post-1214 and Sandy Hook, but this has been an issue on your radar probably preceding your congressional career. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening now and what your hopes are for this initiative.
So we got a bipartisan group of members of Congress, 167 of us, which is not quite at the majority, which is 218 is the magic number, but 167 is a really large number, to submit a letter together asking for a minimum of $75 million to fund the NICS system. The NICS system stands for National Instant Criminal Background Check System. The NICS system, for the last 20 years, since the passage of the Brady Bill, has been the mechanism, principal mechanism, by which we have been able to keep guns out of the hands of bad guys. Not out of the hands of lawful gun owners, but to do our level best to make sure that we're ensuring that when someone purchases a gun that they're legally authorized to do that. And in the last 20 years, the Brady Bill has, and by checking the NICS system, 2.6 million sales have been stopped. And those are sales that would have gone to felons, domestic violence abusers, and people who are seriously mentally ill in a way that could pose a risk to themselves or others. And those are the categories that are under federal law are not allowed to purchase or possess a firearm. And so if the NICS system isn't funded, then we can't do our job in enforcing the law. So it's a backbone, which is why we've been able to get bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. You know, since Sandy Hook, there's been extensive surveys of the public to see what is the attitude about comprehensive background checks, about making sure that we just ask the question and get an answer that this person's allowed to is going to be a responsible gun owner. That's really the question. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be a responsible gun owner or not? Consistently, that support has been over 80%. It's 70% of NRA members, over 80% of gun owners, and between, 88 and 95% or 93% of all Americans support this because it works. Mm. Now, we were successful. I was successful a couple of years ago with another bipartisan group in getting an amendment passed as part of the budget bill, as part of the appropriations process, to put more money into the NICS system. And so I think that's why, we successfully did that, and there's still a large group of us Dems and Republicans who say, you've got to give law enforcement the resources to do their job. And this is part of it. Mm. John, this is part of giving law enforcement the resources to do the job. So I'm cautiously optimistic, despite the partisan divides we're facing, that this proposal, that this request, might be able to get included as part of an amendment when we move forward with the budget. We were able to do it a couple of years ago when Republicans were in control of Congress, of the House, and I'm hopeful we can do it again.
But my what's curious to me is inside the bubble in D.C., when you're talking about 80% of gun owners and 70% of NRA members on the record supporting comprehensive background checks, how is the where is the disconnect with all of the representatives of those demographics in terms of opposition?
It's the way the political system works is extremely sensitive to those who shout the loudest.
Oh, okay.
And what people in elected office all too often, and that's not, we're not talking profiles and courage here.
Sure.
Right? People worry about getting defeated. And defeats usually come from the extremely motivated who really don't like you. Mm. So even if it's a really small percentage, their activism and energy can topple people from office. And that's what some of my colleagues are really worried about, that. Even though overall the public would support them and their districts would support them, what they're afraid of and haven't been willing to be a leader. And leadership is about doing what needs to get done. And my view is it's not worth having the job if you're not going to do it. And some very wise person gave me great advice at one point, said, if there's nothing you care enough about to lose your seat over, you shouldn't run for office.
Mm. Good point.
And that's what I would say to my colleagues. This is about saving the lives of Americans and doing our job. And that shouldn't be a partisan matter.
So when we're looking at these statistics, this 8 out of 10 gun owners, 7 out of 10 NRA members supporting background checks, the proportion of these people who check the box, so to speak, and say they support background checks are not vociferously advocating, whereas the opponents of the expansion of the system are.
Yes, and on top of this, there's been a significant change in the last 10 years or so, and that is the NRA has gone, the big gun lobby, but it's really led by the NRA, but now been added other groups as well, the Gun Owners of America, which is further to the right. But traditionally, the NRA was a member-driven organization and was funded by dues of gun owners. Now, I learned to do target shooting through an NRA course when I was a kid. So do my sons. I enjoy target shooting. I don't have a problem. I have lots of friends who are hunters. I choose not to keep guns in my house, but I don't have a problem with lawful gunners at all. And I would, and I actually went to the ATF range in Washington and, to have a chance to actually fire a bunch of the really big weapons, so I understand what currently is available on the market.
Yeah.
The issue is about who should have access to those weapons, and are they appropriately storing them and making sure others don't get hurt, and that's been my focus. The NRA, though, stopped being funded exclusively by member dues, which they prided themselves on as being highly responsive to their membership, and now they're funded to a large extent by the manufacturers of guns. Okay. Well, you can imagine that's a different motivation. Yeah. You know, it's a different motivation. The manufacturers don't make money if people take care of their weapons and don't buy more. They only make money when you buy more.
Yeah.
Or, as we're seeing now, the newest push is for silencers, to deregulate silencers, mm-hmm. and have concealed carry everywhere by everybody, anywhere, anytime, anybody. And I think of it's like the Barbie dolls.
Yeah.
You know, once you've got the doll, then you got to get the shoes yeah. and the accessories. Yeah. And silencers are the latest push, calling it in an Orwellian way, rebranding it as hearing protection. If you want yeah. hearing protection, wear earplugs or better yet, the nice new, you know, actual headphones yeah. that are good for hunters and target shooters that actually automatically shut off when you're shooting. Mm. So it really protects your hearing,
yeah.
Not silencers, which endanger the public, endanger law enforcement, make crime solving difficult, and are frankly scary. Think about like those Bond movies.
Oh, yeah,
there's a reason
sure. right.
that we've regulated since 1934, we've regulated silencers
yeah.
because, you know, the people who use them were pretty much the bad guys.
Yeah.
And the thought that we would have those available to be bought online
mm.
by anybody, and as we know, we already have a gun show loophole. We already have an internet loophole.
Yeah.
That would put silencers back into that loophole.
Yeah.
That's the wrong direction.
And
that's really been driven, I believe, strongly by the profit motive.
Yeah. Well, and you don't have to look any further than Hartford to see how successful law enforcement has been able to affect arrests and prosecution with the gunshot detector
exactly.
mechanism, which proliferate throughout many urban areas.
Exactly. There's been new technology, and this is where technology can really be our friend.
Mm.
And there are technologies, things like ShotSpotter,
yeah.
which has been very effective in a lot of our cities to help law enforcement pinpoint where violent behavior is happening, where shots are being fired.
Yeah.
They can beef up their patrols. That's safer for communities, and that's where technology, no, that's not about banning
right.
weapons. That's not like, where are the bad guys shooting weapons, and let's go break up this illegal activity and
yeah.
confiscate the weapons, these illegal weapons. It's been very important to reduce crime, and Connecticut's strong gun safety laws have meant that we've seen our death rate by guns dropping dramatically in
yeah.
Connecticut, and it's a testimony to that good laws help.
Yeah.
We haven't taken guns away from people in Connecticut. We've just been more diligent about making sure the law is enforced, and we do a better job of keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, who'd harm other people or themselves.
Or the potential, yeah.
And that's it. And out of people who shouldn't have them, felons. You know, felons should not have firearms. People who have committed domestic violence should not have easy access to firearms. You're, five times more likely to die in a household,
mm.
a domestic violence household, if a gun is present.
Yeah.
Five times more likely. And it's mostly women and children.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
just wrong, and we
oh,
should
yeah,
do a better job.
I mean,
and we
I
see
know,
it.
I know.
You read it in the paper.
And that's another hour show.
That's another hour show. But that's, again, what this bill is about. It's totally common sense. Getting the funding so the system that has worked, when it's used, it works well. We got to make sure it's used. We've got to make sure it has the resources so that states collect this data and report it to the federal system. And when you go to a gun shop or online and you want to buy a gun, it runs through the system, and everybody can have the peace of mind of mm-hmm. knowing you're an authorized buyer.
Good. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Congresswoman Elizabeth Estey from the 5th District here in Waterbury today. A couple of initiatives beyond the background check expansion that we want to touch base on. And one is that Congresswoman Estey and Congressman Larson recently introduced legislation to strengthen and expand Social Security. The Social Security 2100 Act cuts taxes for Social Security recipients and provides some other benefits. Congresswoman Estey, let's brief folks on that, because obviously Social Security is something that has been prominent on the radar in the Trump administration.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, John. Social Security sometimes gets referred to as an entitlement. Social Security is something that you've earned, right? This is money that's been taken out of your paycheck with the promise that when you retire, you're going to get it back. You're going to get it back to ensure that you live your retirement in, you know, not in poverty. And let's remember where this came out. This is an outgrowth of the Depression. And our country's commitment that no senior citizen should be unable to pay their bills or living in an unheated apartment or, you know, living in poverty. And Social Security has been one of the great success stories of the 20th century in America. It has done an amazing job to lift seniors out of poverty. And it would be absolutely the wrong thing to go backwards. It's been something that, you know, has been a top line agenda item for Paul Ryan and the GOP leadership. And John Larson has really been such a champion on this, and I'm joining him again this Congress in reintroducing the so-called Social Security 2100 bill. And that's the idea behind that is to make sure that Social Security will be strong and vibrant and reliable into the 22nd century. So that's the 2100 to the year 2100. Yes. So there are things we can do to ensure that the health and well-being of the trust fund to make sure that it's there for the health and the well-being of seniors in America. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea behind the bill. Now, one thing is Congress has to stop raiding the trust fund, and that's how we got into the mess we're in. Mm-hmm. Congress started raiding the trust fund. So I will stand up strongly and make sure that does not happen. But there are other adjustments we can make, too. And one of those is raising the income level at which we collect Social Security. Now, we've seen that income inequality has grown increasingly with a very dynamic economy, and the lion's share overwhelmingly of those benefits have gone to the top wage earners. But the way Social Security works, and those are folks who have retirement plans out the wazoo, right? They've got every single kind of plan and savings and stock options, and I don't even know what all they have, carried interest, whatever all that stuff is. But the average working person often doesn't have that. We have many fewer pensions. And remember, Social Security was in part of the supplement to pensions. A lot of people had defined benefit pensions. There are not many of those anymore. Mm-hmm. So Social Security has become overwhelmingly what people rely on. Half of Americans who are seniors rely only or overwhelmingly on Social Security for their retirement. Well, those benefits have not kept pace with inflation. That's why I've pushed strongly for not just keeping up with the cost of living adjustment, a COLA, but to have a COLA-E, the cost of living adjustment for elderly. What you buy if you're a senior, my mother is 84, my mother-in-law is about to turn 83. What they spend their money on is rent and food and medicine, right? And heating. Well, those things are not going down, for sure. Those are going up, right? More so than the overall, cost of living, which has been pretty flat because, you know what, flat screen TVs are cheaper. Cell phones are cheaper. Well, that doesn't do my mother or my mother-in-law or most seniors a whole lot of good because they're not buying a lot of those things. Right. What they are buying every day, the everyday prices. And so I think, in fact, we should be, and that's part of what John's bill is doing, is to like look at make sure we have that cost of living. Mm-hmm. And then to raise that income level at which we collect those wages that we collect at to make sure we solidify and strengthen the trust fund so that people can rely on it. Because people don't trust it's going to be there, it causes great anxiety. And I get a lot of calls in the office from folks who are really worried about that. So, you know, it's some tweaks and adjustments for the modern era to make sure it's down there long into the future. So we're going to keep pushing hard for it.
Good. In the last few minutes that we have with Congresswoman Esty, a couple of veterans issues you're backing. When we chat, occasionally, we always touch on these veterans issues, and one that I've been paying a lot of attention to is the Comprehensive Assistance to Family Caregivers Initiative. Also, there's an issue related to veteran suicide. So if you could just take a couple of minutes and brief us on progress on those two fronts.
Sure, absolutely, John. And thank you for your commitment around this, because it's important for people to know. And, you know, we're here in Waterbury City Hall and one of the, you know, Veteran City USA. There's few places in America that cherish and support veterans as much as Waterbury in this area does, or that continue to send as many young women and young men, both, to serve this country. Mm-hmm. I'm enormously, you know, proud and grateful for the opportunity to serve. I'm now on the Veterans Committee. And I'm actually the ranking member, so the top Democrat in charge of one of the most challenging committee that deals with disability appeals. And so that's given me, you know, even more insight into, but ability to move legislation that we need to do. Mm. So I just reintroduced this Care for All Veterans Act. I meet every day families who are caring for their elderly veteran husband or wife, or grandfather or grandmother. And after 9/11, legislation was passed to help post 9/11 veterans' families, to help with support for the caregivers for those folks. We don't do it for all veterans. And if you think, especially in this area, World War II veterans, Korea veterans, now Vietnam veterans, who are cared for by loved ones, that support for the caregivers, giving them training from Easter SEALs, giving them respite days so they can get a little R&R themselves, go visit their kids, just take a little vacation for a few days. These are lifelines. If the American people had to pay for care that is provided out of the love of these families, we could never afford it. And it's not what veterans and families would want. So this legislation we know would be a lifeline for caregivers and be a way of honoring the service of their loved ones who served all of us in this great country. That's why it's been really easy to find bipartisan support for this legislation. Ryan Costello from Pennsylvania and I just reintroduced this. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we may be able to move this forward. And on the issue of suicide prevention, this is the top priority. It's one of my top priorities, top priority of the committee, and top priority of the new VA secretary, Dr. Shulkin, who came and testified before us recently and came to meet with me in my office for 45 minutes, and we talked about the good work we need to do here. So I'm looking at everything we can do, funding more research, doing pilot projects, doing whatever we can to make sure that we stop this epidemic of 20 veterans a day. Committing suicide. That is more than we are losing on the battlefield. And it's wrong. And it's shameful. And we have to do a better job. So that means mental health counseling, a warm handoff when veterans return home, and making sure people are connected. A lot of our younger veterans are not connected at all with each other, with veteran service organizations, or with the VA. So I'm going to be continuing to do everything I can to help bring folks in and make sure that they get the support that they need.
Great. Appreciate you taking the time to speak with our listeners, Congresswoman Esty, and to touch base on this kind of mixed bag of issues that you're working on amongst the dozens that you have your hands on every day in Washington. And great to get some insight on what's going on at the nation's capital. Appreciate you having us, and thank you so much for being part of the program this morning.
Great to be part of it. Thanks so much.
Well, we have been pleased to highlight the great work of ARI on our program before. ARI stands for Always Reaching for Independence, and they help to enrich the lives of people with disabilities and their families and caregivers by enabling them to achieve their fullest potential at home, at work, and in the community. Folks know that we always like to talk about organizations that help enable people to be independent and to have a contributing lifestyle, and certainly folks who have been suffering or saddled with disabilities certainly really they bloom. I really can't think of another way to say it. They really bloom both within themselves and in their communities when they have that opportunity. And it's awesome to be able to highlight ARI for the great work that they're doing. I'm on the line right now with their representatives, Suzanne Kuligowski, who is president and CEO. Gerard Gasparino is also with us and has worked with me for several weeks putting this call together. He's the manager of development and recreation for ARI Connecticut. I want to welcome you both to the program and thank you once again for your work. We also want to remind people that coming up on Sunday, April 30th at Cove Island Park is the 11th annual Walk for Independence. And it's a great way to get out in the fresh spring air at the same time benefit this fantastic organization. So I want to thank you folks for the great work that you're doing and your entire team over there. So I guess we'll start with Suzanne to talk a little bit more broadly about the background on this agency. ARI has been around and serving communities and individuals for quite a long time, haven't they?
We certainly have. This is a milestone year. We're celebrating our 65th anniversary. ARI was formed in 1952 by a group of families who had young children with disabilities and were realizing that there really was no support for them in the community. So they actually put an ad in the newspaper in the Stanford Advocate and invited other parents who had children with disabilities to join them for a meeting. And they absolutely packed a room, much to their surprise. And with the overwhelming support of the community, what was then Aid for Retarded Children was formed. It started out by providing preschool services, nursery services, for five children in 1958. Those were the first services that we provided. Back then, it was not a law that required children with disabilities to be educated in the public school system. So these children were all home, and their parents were left to care for them. And as time went on, of course, we know laws came into play, and all these children need to be educated in the public school system. And so within ARI, they grew up and got older and became adults. And so we started serving and expanding our services to people of all ages. And in 1971, as a result, the name was changed to Aid for the Retarded. And then it morphed into ARI and then ARI of Connecticut when we explored expanding services into New York as well. Mm-hmm. That occurred in 1995. So we now provide services for nearly 150 people with disabilities, ages 18 and up. We provide services for students who are still in high school as they transition and prepare for adult services as they graduate and age out of schools. We have five group homes, four of them in Stamford and one in Ridgefield, and we provide services for individuals who are working in the community. We support them to be successful in their jobs. We support people to live in their own apartments, and we have other group-supported employment and day service options, non-work options as well. We also really feel strongly that as we get so much from the community, we should give back. So many of the people that we serve volunteer in the community to help support people. We have a group that goes out and does friendly shopping for seniors in our local community in Stamford. We volunteer at the hospital and for churches and participate in the senior center. There's lots of things that we do to really make a difference in the community while the community helps make a difference for us.
That's incredible. And as I sort of mentioned a little bit awkwardly there in the introduction, just my experience in seeing individuals like those that are participating and served by ARI, it just is incredible to see, how they essentially, bloom in the community environment. But I think what a lot of people who may kind of come across ARI diplomats or clients in the community, they get that snapshot moment where they may think about them and even maybe inquire and think about and provide some support to ARI. But what they probably don't know and probably couldn't know without what you're going to tell us next is the vast network and how deeply that network is integrated within the organization to be able to deliver the lifestyle and the exposure that your clients enjoy and are able to share in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. We, you know, of course, have a staff that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that everybody that we support receives the services that they need to help them learn new skills and to grow and be more independent to the extent that they are able in their homes, at their jobs, and as they get out and about in the community, you know, shopping and recreating and socializing and participating in sports and other activities. It does take a tremendous amount of staff as well as our volunteers to make all of that happen. But it also requires a lot of support from individuals and businesses in the community to make it happen. You know, we really, as I said, we're founded by just a group of families. Actually, our real deep foundings go back to the Lotstein and the Martin family, the Lotstein family of Grand Central Markets, and the Martin family, who was well known for many, many years here in Stamford, owners of the Frank Martin and Sons store. Mm-hmm. And actually, his granddaughter is still involved at our board level and and involved with our organization. So a third generation, and her children were volunteers through high school. So four generations with that family supporting ARI. It really is a family. One of the things that I truly believe makes ARI very, very special is that we have intentionally stayed relatively small as compared to other organizations that provide similar services, because we believe in that really strong, tight, very individually focused family environment. I think, as I say, that makes us very special and unique. And years ago, when the state was well endowed and funded, and they were providing that support for us, that was a really wonderful thing. Today, it's much more challenging to be that very small sort of mom-and-pop shop in providing the services that we do, because we definitely don't have the same economies of scale as other organizations. But we are fully committed to working hard and struggling a lot throughout every day to make sure that we're making ends meet in order to be able to achieve our mission and to deliver high-quality, valuable services to the people we serve and to give their families the comfort that we're doing that.
Yeah, and you're kind of compartmentalized in the eyes of the funders, especially at the state and federal levels. But the time has come for us to take a quick pause. So, folks, we hope you'll stick with us as we take a quick break and come back to talk a little bit more about the great work of ARI. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, did you know that April is Call Before You Dig Month? So we're going to remind you about this important service with our weekly Call Before You Dig It Minute. Landscaping and construction projects begin or resume every year in April, and those in turn bring the danger of exposure to hits on vital public utility lines. Digging without knowing what is below the surface risks causing property damage, injury, and even death, according to representatives of Call Before You Dig, a nonprofit corporation that's responsible for operating a call center in Hamden to handle excavation notifications, as well as making the public aware of the danger of digging blindly. The organization is comprised of a clearinghouse of owners and operators of underground utility facilities since 1974, including gas, electric, water, and communications companies to protect utilities and public safety. So remember, digging down only a few inches can pose the risk of striking an underground utility, so they must be marked and avoided. And calling before you dig is the law. If you're going to dig, you gotta call 811. That's 811 anywhere in Connecticut. Folks, if you're joining us, we're having a conversation with a couple of representatives of ARI of Connecticut. We're pleased to chat with Suzanne Kuligowski. She's the president and CEO of the organization. Gerard Gasparino is on the line with us as well. He's with Development and Recreation for the organization. Their 11th annual Walk for Independence is coming up Sunday, April 30th at Cove Island Park. We hope folks are hearing something on the program this morning that will inspire them to come out and participate, or perhaps get to know the agency, provide some sort of underwriting assistance. As you hear, they certainly could use it, or even the power of your volunteerism, whether it's hosting an event that will end up being some financial benefit, or just digging in yourself and volunteering with the organization and getting to know and work side by side with not only their incredible staff, but also their incredible clients. ARICT.org is their website. And Suzanne, I have to tell you, just yesterday, less than 24 hours ago, I was having a very, very emotional conversation with a mother of a young man on the spectrum who's a little bit too advanced and self-aware to be able to get any success in kind of a more elementary support program, but not far enough advanced that he isn't going to need to have support. And her frustration was that the workers in the school system where he is going do a really good job in trying to help fulfill the basic educational criteria, but there's not a lot of preparation for these individuals once they hit graduation and transition to life. And I know that your School to Life program really makes a big difference in that respect.
Yes, it is. It's a program that had been much larger in the past. Currently, for a variety of reasons, not just the high school transitions program when the students are still in high school, but I think even more importantly, the program or lack of program at this point for those who are graduating or aging out of high school in the state of Connecticut, there is no funding for graduates to receive any kind of day program or vocational supports after they're out in June. All of that funding has been cut due to the severe financial crisis in the state of Connecticut. So these families are faced with, what do I do with my child, my young adult child, as I need to go to work in order to support my family? And there really are very, very, very limited options. There's tiny bits of money for respite services, but they're really, really small, and certainly nothing for a family that needs full-time support so that they can go out to work. And these families are either having to quit their jobs in order to provide those supports, or pay very large sums of money for somebody to come in and care for their child, or to rely on other family members and friends to make that happen. It is one of the really serious crises in this state, as there is absolutely no funding in the budget for those students after they leave school in June.
And the other on the other end of that spectrum is the terrifying prospect of parents and caregivers who have aged to the point where they cannot really provide the kind of support for their loved ones or their children. Because everyone is living longer, it becomes more of a challenge, which is another thing that ARI is attempting, to the best of your wherewithal, to address.
Yes, absolutely. The residential services are also quite limited in the state. There's not a lot of new growth on new beds being funded, again, because of the state deficit. One of the solutions to that, which the state has been working on, is to close the state institutions and state-run group homes, which are very, very, very costly, and privatizing all of those services. This is a model that has been extremely successful in other states, certainly has the support of advocates and family members and the positive results in other states that has occurred. And it's really the only thing that's going to help figure out this financial crisis for the Department of Developmental Disabilities in the state of Connecticut. because the state will be able to save over $1 billion in the next 5 years by privatizing services. So it is a significant amount of money that will help free up funding for new residential services to be developed. But there hasn't been new services, new beds, new group homes that have opened in several years. The only beds that become available are those that are vacated by others as they typically have either passed on or moved into nursing homes for elder care.
I see. Well, we really appreciate all the information and again, affirming the great work that you folks are doing to the best of your financial ability, which brings us to giving you a break, Suzanne, and thank you for the information. But now we'll pick it up with Gerard Gasparino, who's Manager of Development and Recreation, because as you're hearing, folks, one of the only ways that organizations like ARI are able to do what they are able to do and possibly enhance programming and support for the individuals that they serve is through their own independent fundraising, and the way that they are doing that in the coming weeks is the 11th Annual Walk for Independence on Sunday, April 30th at Cove Island Park, or the annual Lotstein Martin Golf Tournament on June 22nd at Sterling Farms. Gerard, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Give folks all the details that they need to know about getting involved with these events, and we will bid you adieu for today.
Yes, thank you, John. The Walk for Independence has become more or less our signature event of the year, bringing the community, our consumers, our legislators and anyone else involved with ARI together in support of our programs, but also to get the word out about our programs to the community. The walk is on April 30th at Cove Island Park. We don't have a registration fee, which is a little different than most other walks. We do ask participants and the community to support this event by either pledging money or supporting people who are walking, supporting our consumers. We do have our five group homes that we ask people to support them in this walk. We do have volunteer opportunities. Another good thing about our walk is pretty much everything is donated, from beverages to lunch to our bubble. We're having a bubble bus this year, which is geared more for children, but also the adult children around who just
children
like
of all
have
ages.
A good old time.
Yep.
That's being underwritten by one of our supporters. So it's going to be a lot of fun out there at Cove Island Park. We're going to have a bubble bus. We'll have music. We'll have lunch and some games out there. We ask people to stop by. Like I said, there's no registration fee to participate. We do ask people to make a donation if they come out in support of our programs. All of the money we raise goes directly back to supporting our consumers and the programs that they rely on. As for the golf tournament on June 22nd,
yep, got about a minute.
Our 22nd year for this golf tournament, we have all sorts of opportunities for sponsorship, and we do have space open to play. So if people are golfers, for $175, they can come out and play. If they have a foursome, they can book a foursome. If they don't, we'll put them with a foursome. And that includes golf, lunch, dinner, and some prizes that are out there throughout the day.
Great.
All of this information is on our website at www.aricct.org. If people also have Facebook, they could look us up on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, ARI of Connecticut. All the links are on our website. And we just ask the community to support us any way they can by volunteering, donating items that can be used for our raffle, donating in-kind items. We do always have needs in our group homes as well for furniture, gently used clothes and other items that will help our consumers live just a little more comfortably.
Great. We hope that folks will consider coming out and supporting this organization or getting to know ARI better at the website ariCT.org, where you can get links to find out all about them or register for these and other upcoming events. 65 years strong, enriching the lives of people with disabilities and their families by enabling them to achieve their fullest potential at home, at work, and in the community. Always reaching for independence is what ARI is all about. We hope you'll come out and help them out at their upcoming event. And I want to thank our guests this morning once again, Gerard Gasparino, with the manager of development and recreation, and our other guest, Suzanne Kuligowski, president and CEO of ARI. Thanks. Great information this morning, and we'll see you out at the Walk for Independence. Well, a lot of times when we consult with our partners at the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, it's an immediate reaction to a tragedy or an incident that's happened here in our state. But one of the other important initiatives that CCADV carries on is advocacy at the state capitol. And to that end, we are talking to the right person at the agency to brief us on what's happening at the state capitol and in the current session of the legislature on issues that are not only tied to domestic violence, but we'll also be touching base on an initiative going on in regards to paid family and medical leave systems here in Connecticut. We're pleased to chat with Liza Andrews. She is the Director of Public Policy and Communications at the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. If you're interested in learning more about that agency, it is ctcadv.org on the web. Liza, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
So let's get it started. There's a couple of bills that your organization has been tracking and supporting here. And I understand there's also some issues with the paid and family medical leave system. So why don't we start with that one? Because it does have the potential to touch upon any adult in the workforce here in Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about why the Coalition Against Domestic Violence is paying so much attention to a paid family and medical leave initiative.
Because it supports families, and it will give victims as well as their immediate family members the ability to take time, paid time, away from work to help them deal with the aftermath of any violence that they may have been the victim of. And the paid family and medical leave system that's being proposed would be an employee-funded system, so the individuals who would be taking the leave are putting the money in that they can then use to access that benefit.
Now, are individuals who are victims of domestic violence currently able to use the family leave benefit to take the necessary time that they need to handle the collateral issues, court appearances, what have you, or just to begin to recover with or without medical intervention?
There is a law in Connecticut that allows victims of domestic violence to take some time away from work, but it is not paid. There is no paid leave system in Connecticut, and that law does not allow the family member of a victim of domestic violence to take time off to help support that victim through their medical recovery.
So tell us, as we speak, where this issue stands on the State House floor.
It's come out of committee. It's ready for action on the House floor. And again, I think it's a matter right now of working out the specific details of the bill to get support.
Great. And if it is successful, then it will deliver the opportunity for individuals to tap the benefit?
Correct.
Excellent. The next item that CCADV is much more engaged in is House Bill 7299, which is an act concerning strengthening laws concerning domestic violence. Obviously, key to your organization and your network. Liza, tell us a little bit about what's going on with 7299.
The key provisions of that bill seek to strengthen Connecticut's anti-stalking laws and to incorporate acts of suffocation into the state's strangulation laws.
And, well, give us the lowdown on this and
sure.
How it came up.
For stalking, the stalking piece in particular, over 90% of law enforcement agencies, state and municipal in Connecticut, use a screening tool, an evidence-based screening tool known as the Lethality Assessment Program.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a look at our FY16 data on that, and that was over 3,000 screens. And we found that over 70% of victims reported having their daily activities controlled, 49% reported being followed or spied on or subjected to threatening messages, and 46% said they were threatened to be killed by their abuser. So those are all stalking behaviors. But when we look at the arrest numbers, there's less than 100 arrests each year in 2014 and 2015 for stalking and intimate partner violence relationships. So when we kind of look back at the definition in state law of what constitutes stalking, we felt that the threshold needed, which is fear of physical safety, was too high. And 29 other states have recognized that, and they've incorporated substantial emotional distress as a qualifier for being a victim of stalking.
Hmm.
That is a lower level of fear, and that enables the police to intervene in stalking before that violence escalates. Stalking is one of the biggest predictors of fatal intimate partner violence. So we want to make sure law enforcement has the ability to intervene before it ever gets to that level.
Now, how is this kind of adjustment and expansion of eligibility, if you will, to the victim for law enforcement intervention? How is that being received on the law enforcement end?
It's being welcomed. Law enforcement was receptive to it. The Chief State's Attorney's Office was receptive to it. They understand the issue. They understand the limitations of the existing law, and they want to see ways that it's more accessible for them and for victims.
So House Bill 7299, how did that fare in terms of the reaction and support in committee?
It came out of committee unanimously. So far we have good support, and we look forward to continue working with the rest of the legislature.
Great. But I understand there's a caveat that may need a little bit of tweaking in the bill language once it comes up for debate and consideration on the full House.
I'm not sure that there's anything else that we need to change right now. I think we need to continue to have those conversations to understand why the proposal we're making here in Connecticut is similar to what 29 other states are doing, make sure folks understand that and are comfortable with moving it forward.
Okay, great. Then the next and final subject of discussion for this morning is Senate Bill 1011, which is an act increasing the marriage license fee and surcharge. Tell us how that enters into the radar screen for CCADV.
So this is an initiative that we are working on jointly with the Connecticut Alliance to End Sexual Violence. What this does is Connecticut has a marriage license surcharge. Several other states also have those. So it's a small fee, currently $20, that any individual going to seek a marriage license pays, and that money comes right back into the community to fund domestic violence and sexual assault services provided by community-based nonprofits. So that surcharge was initiated in 1992 and has never been raised. So we are seeking to have it raised from $20 to $35, and that brings us more in line with some of our neighboring states. New Hampshire has a $50 surcharge. Vermont has a $60 surcharge. So we're proposing Connecticut go from $20 to $35.
Mm. And, you know, although on face that doesn't seem like a lot of money in total, or when considering the increase. For some people, particularly those who may be kind of in that paycheck to paycheck situation, that nearly doubling of the fee might be viewed as a little onerous. But you're saying that that level of fee for the purpose it is designed is bringing it up to $35 would bring Connecticut into uniformity with a number of other states that have a similar initiative?
It would be, and it generates over an additional $300,000 to fund these important services, and it hits a limited number of individuals. Connecticut sees about 19,000 marriage license applications each year. So it's a limited number of people who are going to be impacted by that fee, and it also includes those individuals who choose to come from out of state, you know, and particularly get married along Connecticut's beautiful shoreline.
Yeah.
They have to apply for a marriage license here.
Okay. Well, as we speak here on April 20th, when we're recording this interview, where does that bill stand in the process and at the State House?
That bill is still waiting for a vote in the Finance Committee, so we hope to see it move along before the end of next week.
And no schedule on that?
Not at this time.
Okay. Great. Well, anything else that is imminently going on in Hartford that we need to know about?
No, I think that about covers it.
Excellent. Well, it's great to check in with you, Liza, and get up to speed on the issues that are going on at the State House. We hope folks will keep an eye on things here in Connecticut and support with phone calls, emails, or other contacts to their legislators if one of these three initiatives or a combination of them rings true to their hearts and they're so inclined to provide that level of support directly to their own legislators. So thanks for joining us. Liza Andrews is the Director of Public Policy and Communications for the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. CTCADV.org is their website. The coalition is the state's leading voice for victims of domestic violence and those agencies and the network that serve them. Liza, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.